deploying contracts, for example, it should be able to simulate stuff like that, which V3 cannot do. I think because it's very early stages, it would take me a lot longer to like fully flesh it out. I don't have a full picture in my head of exactly what the final product will look like, but it is designed to get closer to what a manual order took to find, for example.
Scraping Bits is brought to you by the following sponsors. MEV Protocol. Maximize your ETH staking value with MEV ETH, exclusively on MEV.io. And Composable. Execute any intent on any chain, coming soon to Mantis.app. That's MANTIS.APP. And Fastlane Labs, the only MEV and intent-centric team that has a daily deodorant application rate of over 68%. GM, everyone. My name's Degachi, the host of Scraping Bits. And today, I have Chase Delight, the infamous bot racer from C4. How's it going, friend?
Hey, happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Happy to have you on as well. I'm excited to talk about the bot races. Just for the people that aren't familiar with you, who are you and what do you do?
Sure, I'm Chase, also known as Chase Delight. I built Light Chaser, which is an order bot with over 800 detectors. I use Light Chaser to compete in Code Arena bot races, of which I'm currently, as of speaking, the number one bot racer. And I also offer Light Chaser privately as well for private clients.
Very interesting. This was something I wanted to do back in the day, but I never actually switched into AI. So it's great to see what I could have become.
I remember you mentioning it to me ages ago. Yeah, that was really interesting.
Yeah. How did you get into all this? Were you doing cybersecurity before, automated tooling, or what happened? How did you get to this point?
Yep. So I'd say I was pretty much a automator from the start. So even when I was in the university, all of my projects were automation based. Because, you know, like every year you have a project, and I pretty much exclusively did like automation stuff. And even when I started my professional career, I kind of started off as a regular software engineer, but regardless of what team they put me in, pretty much after a couple of months, I would somehow find a way to pivot into automation. Because, you know, pretty much all of these teams, they have like a set handful of tasks, which they do on a weekly basis. And obviously, inevitably, I would get those tasks, especially if you're new to the team. They tend to give those kind of tasks to the newer people. And they tend to be quite tedious. So I just used to automate them all the time. And so, yeah, I was pretty much an automator from the start. I'd say I got like my start with Web3 security automation primarily when Code Arena bot races were a thing, because I kind of had Light Chaser V1 framework already done. I made it ages ago for fun, essentially, because... Well, people don't really know this, but V1 was very rudimentary. It was originally, I made it because how you have these different like pancake swap, Uniswap, ages ago. I didn't even know what a smart contract was. Obviously, I knew programming, but I bought something, I think it was on pancake swap, and then my money just vanished. It wasn't very much, so it was nothing that was particularly upset about. But I was like, huh. Where did that money go? So then I kind of looked into it, and that's how I realized what the hell a smart contract was. And I kind of like started learning Solidity. I learned how to learn Solidity relatively quickly. A lot of the, I'd say, vulnerabilities, at least at the time, were pretty automatable. Like it was the same couple of steps that you would look at when you were looking at a piece of a contract. You would look for the same things again and again and again. And with me being an automator at heart, I was like, you know what, this could probably be automated. And at the time, I didn't even know that Slither existed. But then when I was kind of like looking into it more, then I kind of realized, but I had I put a rule on myself. I will not look at this Slither's code until Light Chaser V1 is done. And the reason for that was I didn't want to become like subconsciously influenced by a Slither, because I was worried that if I did that, I would basically just end up making a glorified Slither clone without like realizing it, like subconsciously. And I'm glad I did that, because Light Chaser is like a completely, went down a completely different path. It's like, quote unquote, different skill tree. But yeah, that worked out. And then I put that on the back burner and kind of forgot about it. And obviously I started my full-time job, so I just focused on that. And then I was like, you know what? I kind of want to get back into Web3 security, because that was really interesting to me. So, but then it was perfect timing, because that's pretty much exactly when Code Arena announced Code Arena bot races. I was like, hey, I already have a framework ready. Let me just build on top of that. And then for the next, I'd say, 2-3 months of competing on Code Arena bot races, I upgraded to Vue. And then I'd say about 5-6 months after that, I finally upgraded to V3. Mm. And that's how I got my start, pretty much.
What was it like going from V1 to V2, V2 to V3? What did it take to really test and ship these new features? And did you have to do any complete re-architectures at all?
Well, thankfully, no, because when I developed V1, I was pretty fortunate in the sense that I already made it very, very modular. Because my code was super modular, it was pretty straightforward to upgrade. So V2 is built on top of V1, and V3 is built on top of V2. So the way it kind of works is a V3 detector, as it executes, it then devolves into a V2 detector, and then finally devolves into a V1 detector. So it's fully backwards compatible. You can use V1 detectors with the V3 framework, and you can use V2 with the V3 framework as well. And I think that's been a pretty big strength, because it allowed me to like move exceptionally fast when it comes to upgrades. I pretty much make a major upgrade every single week. And pretty straightforward, I'd say, because of backwards compatibility and everything.
This is all for a bot race, right? So we haven't even touched on this, but what is a bot race?
Yeah, absolutely. So a bot race is pretty much a group of quote-unquote qualified bot racers such as myself. You do have to qualify first. And let me just quickly go over how that works. Essentially, I'd say every month or two, Code Arena announces for a particular contest, anybody who has a bot of their own can essentially participate in this qualifier, and you send all of your bot reports for that particular contest to C4. And then a judge looks through all those reports and then compares them to the number one bot in the actual bot race, not the qualifier, but the actual bot race. And if you get at least 60% of what the number one bot got or higher, so you do have to qualify first, and there's only 20 slots available. But those 20 bot racers, essentially for, I'd say, 80% of the contests, not all of them get bot races. It's usually the Solidity ones. At the start of the contest, you have a one-hour submission window to essentially run the code base through your bot and submit the subsequent report to C4. And then they all get graded individually, and the number one bot gets published. And if you get 80% or higher of the number one bot, then you get a grade A. If you get between 60 and 80%, then you get a grade B. But there's no rewards for grade C, and which is basically anything below 60% of the number one bot, I believe.
Interesting. Okay, so actually, when I was trying to do these bot races, there was kind of three modules that you need. It's, first of all, you have to grab the repository from the website. So you need to kind of scrape it and then download it and then convert it into whatever, you know, whatever you want to perform analysis on. So let's say if it's Solidity and my one does, let's say, bytecode analysis, then I have to convert that Solidity, all those contracts, combine them and perform all the analysis on it, which is the second component, is, you know, whatever you do, static analysis, dynamic analysis, then that's what you do. But then once you find stuff and you can actually generate an exploit, which, you know, this is what I would do. I would generate the exploit and then I would show, then you would have to write a report or automate the report because it's all happening in an hour. I think, which you would use like an LLM for, it's quite easy. But yeah, what was your process like? Just, that's what I would do.
Yeah, of course. So when it comes to getting the report that you're currently auditing, like the current contest that has a bot race, that part isn't automated because Lightchaser operates completely offline. That's just like by design. I wanted it to be that way because if I ever did decide to take on a private client, I'm not sure how they'd be okay if it had like internet access or anything, so it doesn't touch the internet. So the way I kind of do it is I have a separate program which essentially you just put in the link to not actually the C4 website contest page, but the actual GitHub contest page. So then it just grabs from there. And then, do you know the README text? It has the scope within that. It then just looks at that and it goes through the contest repo and it only grabs those particular contract files to analyze, essentially. And so that's how I do the first stage. The second analysis is pretty much just me selecting what detectors I want selected and just hitting enter pretty much, because the work has already been done in that front. The detector's already there. So like I mentioned before, Lightjes is pretty modular. So I actually do have a feature where I have a set of detectors for L2 projects only. I have another set for ZK projects only, and have another set for which accept arbitrary ERC-20 tokens. So I have all these different subsets of detectors. And so once I actually have the repo within Lightchaser, I can then choose, okay, which one of these subgroups do I also want to select? So I have like a default set, which is like all the detectors which I run regardless. Then I choose some of the subsets as well. This is explained on my Twitter as well. And then I just hit smash enter and wait a couple of minutes. It usually takes between 5 to 10 minutes, but significantly large code bases such as Maya, for example, which I believe is like 30,000 lines of code or something like that, it could take a little longer. It take 15, 20 minutes. But once I got the report, I basically just submit it. The submitting part is pretty straightforward. My bot has two outputs. It has the MD file, and then it has a JSON file, because Code Arena does actually require your submission to be in the JSON format now, and they have a specific schema which you have to follow. Lightjes already has that integrated, so it produces both. And I just submit the JSON file through the submission portal, and yeah, I'm good to go pretty much.
Interesting. When you talk about your analysis part, you say you have all these detectors, so is it all statically coded then? It's not actually dynamic?
That's, yeah, pretty much. It's yeah, mostly AST stuff, pretty much, yeah.
Okay, so it's basically like a sliver then, if it's just all detectors, right? Or how does it differ from something like sliver?
I'd say it's more dynamic than, I believe I explained this on Twitter as well, but it's more dynamic than something like Slither, because it doesn't use, it's semi-dynamic. I'd say that's a good way of explaining it, because with the, like, for example, search terms are dynamic. It doesn't just look for static strings. It can actually look at the code base and, depending on the code base, change its own search terms based on that particular code base. So it's not 100% static. I'd say it's somewhere between static and dynamic analysis. But yeah, that was V3 tech. So in V2, it was completely static. In V3, I kind of moved over from just the scopes being dynamic to even the search terms being dynamic. So it is dynamic in that sense, I suppose. Yes. Yeah, pretty much.
So it sounds like you're not actually deploying any contract and then running any tests through it, like a fuzzer, for example. It sounds,
that's right,
a lot like, okay, you have the AST and now you're just looking for common pitfalls. But how do you go about that if it's, let's say it's a bit, the compiler is a different each time, different depending on which compiler. So it could be a lot more code to get to the same point, or a little bit of code to also get to that same point. So how does it handle that?
So that's the great thing about Lightjes, is that because I built the parser from scratch, when it comes to like different compiler versions and everything, it can handle that pretty well. It kind of has a specific rule set for, like, for example, Solidity versions of 8 and above, and it has like different like subset for 8 and below. So it can handle that pretty straightforward. But typically speaking, the vulnerabilities that you see are pretty much universal. Like, it doesn't necessarily really matter on what compiler version, but you do have some which the compiler version does matter. A great example of this is some of the assembly detectors. I believe there was a bug in, it's like an assembly bug which got patched in 8.14, I believe it was, or 8.014. And obviously that doesn't apply if the compiler version is higher than that. And Lightjes can actually pick that up and exclude it if that is the case. So it will only look for those particular vulnerabilities if the compiler version is 8.14 and below, for example.
Why did you only do static analysis rather than, let's say, dynamical with fuzzing and symbolic, for example?
To be honest with you, yeah, it just didn't fit within the time window. I don't think I can build something that can do everything within the 1 hour time limit. And also, when it comes to fuzzing, I do believe that the current tools out there meet the needs pretty well. So I didn't see the point in essentially reinventing something that's already done pretty well. I kind of wanted to build something where there was a gap. And I believe Lightchaser kind of was able to fill that.
The reason why is because if you're trying to find a very complex exploit, for example, let's say Pickle Finance, where you have to actually generate contracts, 5 different ones, and then, for example, like a delegate call is dependent on an ERC-20 dot balance of, I mean, these are pretty dynamical, and depending on what you return for that, you can now access pools that you're not really meant to access. But also, yeah, generating these contracts, so you have to basically generate the contract, the ERC-20 one, and then put in as a return value for ERC-20 dot balance of an address rather than an amount. And so it's a custom implementation for this interface, and then that's what's inserted. So are you able to find complex critical bugs at all with static analysis? Static analysis, there we go. Yeah, are you able to find complex bugs at all, or is it more of just like find the common patterns?
So for now, it's primarily common patterns. What you call a V3 isn't at the stage where it can do something on par with a complex manual audit. So even when I like work with third party, like private clients and everything, Lightchasers was never supposed to be something to replace manual auditors. Rather, it's just another like step in the audit process. So these more complex bugs is something that a human being would excel at. Where automation excels is finding these common patterns, because it can do hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of different patterns for a particular code base within 5 minutes. That's not something that a manual human auditor can do. But the pitfalls of that is obviously when it comes to more complex bugs like the ones you just mentioned, a manual auditor would be far better at finding those. I'd say automation has its own specific like requirements and its own lane. But when it comes to developing more advanced techs like the one you just mentioned, that's not something that V3 is looking to do, but V4 will be able to find like high and critical vulnerability findings far more often. It'd be far better at that. But V4, because of how complex, it's an exponential jump from V3. It's taking me a considerable amount of time to develop it. But that is a lot more dynamic than V3 or V2. But it does come at the price act speed, rather. It takes a lot longer to run a V4 detector than it does a V3 detector. And because of the complexity, I'm not estimating V4 to be done anytime soon. But it is in development. But V4 will be able to, I'd say, get closer to where I want automation to go.
So what would V4 look like then? What kind of techniques you're going to be using?
Nothing definitive, but like you mentioned, deploying contracts, for example, it should be able to simulate stuff like that, which V3 cannot do. But I think because it's very early stages, it's very early in development, it would take me a lot longer to like fully flesh it out. I don't have a full picture in my head of exactly what the final product will look like. But it is designed to get closer to what a manual auditor can find, for example. Mm. But if you ever have a podcast like a couple of months from now, I should be able to share more regarding that. It's still pretty early right now.
Obviously, all of the actual exploits are complex, all the like really big
Absolutely.
Ones. And so this is something that should be focused on. And I've said this a fair amount of times, and people don't agree, that can all be automated. Humans will no longer be needed for this, because it is a very rule-constrained game. And although, yes, there is tons of possibilities, if you have a strong enough system, like let's say a HFT system where you're using like FPGAs to create your own hardware and run them in parallel, like very beefy setups, you know, like servers type thing. And you run parallel fuzzers simultaneously that assist each other, and also combine that with, you know, some type of AI model, where it's able to learn over these millions of trial and errors, it will be able to pick up some stuff, right? So it's a time game of who develops it first. Obviously, it's not easy, mm-hmm. which is why it hasn't been done, but that's the end game. And that will be able to cover all of these detectors as well, all 800 and more. That's just kind of like a typical fuzzer. Absolutely. But as long as it's able to direct itself, right, that's kind of really what it is. And the only reason that hasn't happened is because nobody's developed it. But yeah. That's my little rant. So
I do kind of agree where like automation, it can definitely go further, which is why I even started development of V4. Because if you actually look at my performance, especially like in something like bot races and even with my private clients, that is going pretty well, even without V4 being in place. But the reason why I'm developing V4 is because I do feel like in the future, automation will play a much larger role. And because of that, I do kind of want to be at the forefront of that. So I am planning on taking Lightchaser down that route of essentially developing something that gets closer and closer to the skill level of a manual auditor. I don't know how long it would take because I am a solo team, but it is definitely something that I have in the works in the long run.
Yeah, definitely. It's a hard road because that's what I was doing. You've got to build like your own forking system, your emulator. And since these bugs are all, you know, they all do require like the stars to align in a certain way. And these stars are four different things. You have all these different contracts, all their different functions, all their different states, and then all the different call data. And you have to align all these perfectly and they all affect everything else. So you could have the same vulnerability, but it's in a different state. It's no longer a vulnerability in that like particular state, right? So it's very contextual. Yeah. It's very stateful. And like stateful fuzzing is really difficult. It's like probably the most computational heavy type of testing if it's all relying on state. You're changing one thing and then you build up this giant corpus, and usually it's better to just slice the corpus in half and keep going. Instead of just continually spamming new ones, it correlates really highly with mutation and natural selection, actually, is what I've realized after reading these books. And that's why I think like AFL was really good, because it's just random and it's able to find this and it has no bias. And that's kind of what happens with evolution as well, at least from what my current knowledge. Could be debated whether you're religious or not, but it is very interesting nonetheless. And like looking at, you know, all these types of different fuzzing, like directed fuzzing is really good, mutation fuzzing, all this other stuff, it's super useful. And I think that is the pinnacle of this type of automation, because you'll never find real bugs, real complex bugs, without, you know, the spatial awareness, because they are all in different kind of fields and you've got to combine them all together rather than, you know, sequentially trying everything, because you'll just start from, you know, nothing and eventually keep going infinitely. And that's like completely impossible unless you have, you know, dozens of years, thousands of years, or like insane computing. But who knows when that happens. So you have to kind of adjust to the rules of the game. But what do you think actually separates yourself from these other bot races at the moment?
Yeah, I'd say primarily my focus, because I've been primarily focused on, rather than building detectors themselves, I focus a lot more on the actual underlying framework tech, like I mentioned, V4. So I do, obviously, I'm sure you know this, in bot races, typically when a bot wins a contest, essentially, all the other bots, all the new rules that get revealed through the published report, all the other bot races like copy those, essentially. So then the bots kind of like, it's like a const race in that regard. So the way I kind of want to take, like you mentioned, what I feel differentiates myself is that I'm trying to take Lightchaser in the direction where the detectors which I build on, for example, V4, is something that can't be emulated on other frameworks unless they develop their own equivalent of V4. So that's the direction I'm trying to go in. I'm trying to get to a point where, essentially, provided you don't build a completely new framework, you can't compete with V4 detectors. That's the kind of path I want to take. I still, like I mentioned earlier, it's still pretty early days, but I've done some pilots here and there, and I am definitely moving in the right direction in that regard.
Interesting. Yeah, I think it's actually quite interesting, because if you did transition into fuzzing or dynamical testing, then it would be able to become like a fully fledged company where you can like charge a lot of money, first of all, but also secure a lot of protocols in ways that matter. Obviously, common patterns are great, but there's so many tools for very basic things. And the hardest thing, which is why there's so many hacks, are the complex bugs. If you get rid of that, you're minimizing the amount of risk overall for crypto and increasing the chances of it actually getting accepted by institutions, etc., which is obviously the end goal. Well,
right.
At least that's what we hope. Some people in here, well, majority of people are just there for the money. But the true value of it is to turn it into like something that is meaningful and actually changes the world financially. But that is the way. Absolutely. And obviously, if you do this, there's insane money on the table, because now every protocol is going to come to you. More people are going to get in the game. You know, all this stuff is going to come. Whereas, like, simple detectors is, like, very easy. Like, if we think of, like, what's a good analogy? There's a lot more people that are good at doing very simple things than they are at the people doing very advanced, complex things.
Right.
And then when you get into, like, the automation side, it's an even more narrow niche. And if you, like, add AI onto that, AI, cyber is even more narrow niche. And the more you keep adding, there's less competition.
The moat gets bigger, so to speak.
Exactly. And it's still amazing that you're doing, you know, you've actually got clients now privately. So what was the process of actually getting these clients and acquiring them and even retaining them?
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of getting clients, I didn't actually start off with any sort of marketing. I kind of just would publish every time I would like score high. I would just basically share like how Lightcase is doing on Twitter. And then I had some people like reaching out asking, hey, do you offer this privately? And at the time, I would pretty much say, oh, no, not right now. But then kind of like, I'd say late 2023, early 2024, I started actually like trying it out. Like, okay, let me take on a private client and see how it goes. And they went pretty well. But like in the super early days when I had my first few clients, there were some things which I had to iron out, which that really helped to identify. I'd say like one of the issues is some clients, for example, didn't want the entire range of detectors. They only wanted the really high value, high impact ones. And because Lightcase was quite modular, I was able to create essentially custom profiles for each of my clients, which only had detectors that they cared about. So that was like pretty early days. And then essentially when January kind of came around, I had a mix of clients either reach out to me or I reached out to them. Hey, I see you do private orders. So do you want to try implementing Lightcase as part of your pre-order process? I mean, that's one very key factor. I never once advertised Lightcase as a manual order replacement. So essentially, in my, I'd say, main copy, essentially what I mentioned is breaking down a protocol's order journey into four steps. First, you pretty much run it through Lightcase, for example, or another automated tool, to pretty much get rid of all the low-hanging fruit and like all the glaring, blatant weaknesses. Get all those out of the way, because the last thing you want is to go ahead with a manual auditor and all you get back is stuff like, use a safe transfer instead of transfer. Like, nobody really wants to get that back from a manual auditor. But if you run it through, for example, Lightchaser, you pretty much get all of those bugs taken care of. And you can also use it as a out-of-scope list for manual auditors, provided to a manual auditor, and then they can just find the more unique, the more valuable, high and critical findings, like the ones that you mentioned. And then, so that would be like the second stage, which is the manual audit. Third stage would be competitive audits, like CodeHawks or Code Arena or Sherlock. And then the final stage would be essentially bug bounties. So that's how I would essentially explain it to all my prospect clients. And that seemed to work pretty well because there's a lot of advantages of running your bot through automation. One thing is the wide coverage. For example, if you have 800, 900 detectors, that's a lot of different individual vulnerabilities that you can scan your code through. And on top of that, you can essentially, from right off the bat, you get a list with like 100 plus different findings. And then you can give that to a manual auditor as a out-of-scope list. And also manual auditors can use that to expand particular vulnerabilities into high and criticals. Because I do apologize, I don't remember exactly who mentioned this, but I believe it was Alex, the entrepreneur. But he mentioned that a high vulnerability is essentially just a combination of like two medium vulnerabilities or something along those lines. So by giving the final report to a client and then to the manual auditors, they can actually use that report to help them find higher value, higher critical, like more critical vulnerabilities. So it could be used in that way. So there's quite a lot of benefits, which I definitely discussed to my like prospect clients about. And that's how I've been getting sales. And things have been ramping up recently. In fact, most of my current clients actually reached out to me rather than me reach out to them. So things are definitely growing and the demand is growing. So if you are on the fence on getting into automation, now is definitely a good chance, because there's not many players in the field there's only like 20 bot races on CodeRina, for example. It's a very good niche to get into right now.
Definitely. I think the transition from bot racing into actually, you know, a company for cybersecurity is a good like progression, natural progression. How do you kind of see that scaling out though? Do you think you'll hire people or continue going by yourself, getting into different fields like AI? But what do you think?
Well, I definitely do want to start a company at some point. I spoke with my accountant a couple of months back, and even he recommended that, okay, I am pretty close to the point where I should, instead of operating as a sole trader, for example, actually fully transitioning into a company. So I don't have any confirmed dates or anything like that, but I do see in the future, like in 2024, I will probably open a company or something along those lines and operate through that, because I am getting a lot more demand. So it makes more sense for me to operate as a company rather than a sole trader. But when it comes to staff, that one's a bit pretty tricky one, because I this is something I've been thinking about. When it comes to working on Lightchester itself, I'm not sure how okay I am with, an employee, for example, actually having access to the code. Obviously, it's still super early days, but especially with V4 being developed, because V4, like I mentioned, is an exponential jump from V3. Mm. So I'm more on the side of hiring people to do things which aren't relating to the code itself. That could be, for example, dealing with the clients, client outreach, or essentially compiling, essentially like stuff that you would usually do yourself, but it's very time consuming, but it's not like sensitive or anything like that. Those are the kind of tasks which I'm looking to outsource for like an employee or something like that. In fact, I actually have like a lot of as an interest in starting off with the intern rather than a full-on employee and see how that goes, use that to test the waters, because there's a lot of tasks which are extremely time consuming. For example, let's say I provide a report, and I'm not talking about private reports, but a public report which is publicly available, publicly viewable by anyone. I want to go through that report myself, and because there could be like over 100 findings. I want to go through that report to find any false positives, because I don't want there to be, ideally, Lightchester wouldn't produce any false positives. And to help me like get towards that goal, I would, like right now, I go through the reports myself and to identify them. That's the kind of tasks which I can offload to an intern, for example, provided the report is public. I would never do that with a private report, for example. I'll just do that myself in that case. Hopefully there'll be a company this year.
Definitely. I remember I tried to do the same, actually. So I made the company, and I had the same issue. I was like, I don't want to release or have them see the entire repo. So a good solution, actually, is just modularizing it and letting them work on certain things. You can take that into the core. So, yeah, you can kind of have them specialize in a certain thing. For example, I had a quote-unquote intern. I wouldn't really say that, but we were working together. He would show me the ropes on like Web2 security and forensics, and I was showing him like Web3 stuff and giving him mentorship on that. And what he did was work on modules outside of the actual code base that would be implemented into the code base, but were still like important, right? And so it's kind of a two-way street. But if you want to upgrade your current architecture, I mean, you're going to have to eventually modularize it so they can work on it, which, you know, becomes trust. And that's kind of the whole point of working in a team, is trust. Otherwise it doesn't really work. That's the advice I got.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I did want to ask, how come you decide you didn't continue with your security automation work? I'm talking specifically building a bot for CodeArena, for example, because you mentioned that there were quite a few like shortcomings that in what you envisioned for security automation. So how come you didn't go essentially continue with on that path?
Yeah, I think the major one is the realization that AI is a lot better than what people think it is in terms of cybersecurity, especially in a ruled, confined game like, you know, EVM security. It's very, I think AI enhances it quite a lot. And you don't have to do it, obviously. But I think in the future, definitely, there's just going to be a few companies, if not just one, that will be able to completely dominate the market. It'd just be like AI-based fuzzing. And I initially had like a lot of I was pushing back on this for a long time, like a couple months of, you know, this isn't really you know, AI is just fuzzing with extra steps, but it's not that.
Right.
It actually learns and it becomes intuitive, and it's no longer fuzzing at that point because it now has, you know, past experience over, you know, multiple projects, multiple runs. And so I thought it was kind of futile me doing a manual one. Although I do have now, I still have the idea that I want to go back and finish it, but also long-term thinking, it's much better to get into AI, even if you're not like creating models from scratch. It's still better to understand them, and then you have a pathway to creating them. It pulls you into math and, you know, that kind of architecture anyway. So then you can upskill, and you can keep upskilling like that. I mean, you can just keep going down like the cybersecurity route and automated tooling, but eventually you're going to hit a point where you're versing someone doing the exact same thing with you, with, you know, a custom model, and you will never be able to beat them.
Right.
Because in order to implement all these, you know, heuristics, which there is a lot,
right,
because it's always changing, right? You would never beat something that learned in an automated way and implements it itself, because you're going to have to implement all of it. Like, for example, the right, detectors is a great example.
Right.
So basically, it's like a mind for cybersecurity, and it can run in parallel, right, and have way more compute than you, think in way more dimensions than you, and run 24/7. It's just very powerful conceptually. And there's just, when you think about it, with the trade-offs of manual implementation versus something actually learning, it's like a mind literally dedicated to it, like an entire being. It's,
right,
you know, if it's done incorrectly, there's no competition at all. And it makes sense to pursue that, even though it may be the long road. You know, anything worth doing is hard, right? I think, yeah, long term, it's way better doing that if you want to really invest in the future. Because then you're going to get to a point in the future where you're like, oh, I wish I did this, you know? And although you might have made a lot of money with the mm-hmm. previous thing, what's the opportunity cost of what is what it comes down to?
Yeah.
What are you willing to trade off?
Well, in that case, should we have a unofficial competition to see who could get there first between me and you?
Definitely not. I think, like, I don't know, I'm doing a lot of things. I kind of jump from topic to topic. But, oh, you want to get into AI? Right.
Well, if there's a, like you mentioned, if that's like the future, then it's definitely not on the roadmap right now, but things will probably end up going down that direction in the future. Who knows?
Yeah. What I predict for you is, since you've already done the stack analysis kind of stuff, you're going to fall into the same kind of realm I did, where you go into taint analysis, you discover how like amazing that is, and then you build your own EVM emulator, forking system, build a fuzzer, build symbolic execution. And then as you're building the fuzzer, you're like, wait, this is perfect for AI. And you'll fall down the exact same route. Or you'll just continue doing it and finish it, you know, do what I didn't. Those are like the two kind of pathways, the two branches. But yeah, I truly believe like AI is very powerful. And we're in the time where it's like the most powerful technology, right, like ever.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. Have you heard of Aiko by any chance?
Oh, yes. I was actually going to do a podcast with him, the guy that created it.
Yeah.
But we've delayed it a few times.
Yeah, I mean, that's very similar to what you're saying, but for Web 2, I believe. I'm not sure if it's a Web 3 thing.
He wants to get into Web 3, but I believe his one's based off this paper where it's fuzzing with like an LLM that assists in the inputs. But it's not like AI. Oh, yeah, I mean, it's AI fuzzing, but his one's a bit different to, like, that paper. I don't know specifically right. What happens, but his one's very successful. He's doing really well with Aiko. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I see him all over my feed.
Yeah, he's blown up a bit, yeah.
His Twitter is really fun.
K-E-I-O-X.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, he's a very interesting thing. And, you know, you hear a lot of people talking about, you know, fuzzing and AI. It's kind of like this buzzword. And when you go into like these fuzzing group chats and you mention AI, they're all like very doubtful of it. And they're like, oh, you would never do it if you don't have a PhD. Like all of these like PhDs are doing it. What makes you think you're different? And, you know, it will never happen. Right. But like, again, it's the same in Web3. When you talk about complete automation, they're very skeptical, mainly because it will completely replace them and they're not upskilling. And, you know, that's just kind of, you know, natural selection, I guess, right? In the perfect form. So there's a reason why they're denying it and not doing it. you've got to be contrarian to these beliefs and really push for it. Otherwise, you can't do it, right? So if you can open your mind and really see the potential and believe in it and not be in this denial stage, then it's quite obvious what the steps are and you should definitely walk towards it. But again,
100%, like the thing I would say about myself is I am pretty competitive when it comes to these kind of things. If I ever kind of like catch wind that there's like some new, for example, automation around the corner and like it's next level, I'll probably go into overdrive mode and try and beat it, essentially. So yeah, I'm actually pretty excited for things to like get to the next level. This is something I've actually spoken about with some people who I know. Essentially what they asked is, what would happen if, for example, if some other company crops up and they build something that's like next level Web3 security automation that blows like Lightchaser out of the water, for example. And I would say this is pretty arrogant, but I just pretty much said, nah, I'd win. Like, I'd probably just go into super hyper overdrive mode and start working like 18 hours straight every single day until I beat it. So I personally actually want things to get very competitive and very difficult. That's kind of the way I want things to be, because that's how I have the most fun, to be honest with you. But yeah, I'm pretty excited for the future.
I mean, like, in the future, it would definitely be a few people. For example, one of them, Lucas Martin Calderon, with Pentestify, right? Like, he's doing complete AI cybersecurity. And, you know, if you don't have an AI, you can't compete at all. Like, it's just as simple as that. So you're literally forced to upskill. Because he's done what I was mentioning before. Like, you're at the intersection of multiple disciplines. So, you know, cybersecurity and AI, right? And he's done cybersecurity and Web2 as well.
And Web3.
Yeah, and Web3, right? So you're combining all these different things. He's also really good at math, right? But this is like the type of caliber you'll be facing when you get to this level. You need the multiple disciplines and the intersection between them all to really grasp the ideas. Because without one discipline, you might not have the same ideas as someone that has done both, right? You're just lacking that knowledge. So you can't think in that area, at least as deeply. Employees should be people that specialize in certain things, and then you have that is able to come up with the ideas and direct them how they all work. And that's in my like current understanding of how it would work. That's what I would do. You have kind of all the ideas of how they all intersect because you are like you either deeply know everything in those fields, or you know it might be like mediocre, but know like a lot of it in all of the fields, and then you can direct all the specialists which are really great at one thing and combine them with someone that's really great with another thing, and you're like that intersecting link, I guess, that bridge to connect it all. That's my kind of thoughts right now. Otherwise, I would definitely still be doing it, I think.
To be honest with you, like, this is purely selfish, but I kind of want you to stay in the Web3 security automation field, because I just want to have like some really top tier people to go up against.
I mean, honestly, like, the best way is to be better than yourself, you know, because you're going to reach a point in your life, hopefully, that there is no competition. Then the only competition you have is yourself and being better than yourself and going beyond that.
Yeah.
You know, imagine people like at the top of their game, like you're kind of at it now, you know, if there's no competition, there's always competition. They're always coming up. It's just a race, and they might be like a mile, 5 miles behind, but they're still coming, and you've got to keep that distance. But you know, people also build in silence, so it's a forever race, I guess. Yeah, you just don't know when you might get hit behind.
I mean, that's the thing. Like when I, for example, I got the first like number one position on CodeReading bot races, instead of just building more detectors, I decided, okay, so there's a certain ceiling that V3 detectors can get to, like a certain complexity of vulnerabilities that they can find. Right now, even though I achieved what was then my goal of getting the number one spot, I kind of wanted it to get to the next level in the sense, because what I could do is I could just keep on making V3 detectors forever and maintain my spot that way. But the problem is the actual, I'd say, complexity, the complexity ceiling won't go up. That's why I started developing V4, and making V4 has been really time consuming, because it's a quite a big jump from V3. but it's worth doing because I kind of want to see the absolute limit that I can get to building the iChaser.
Definitely.
I completely see your point.
Yeah, I think if you want to venture into the world of math and AI, which is incredibly difficult,
yeah,
it's definitely worth it.
Yeah, I mean, if that's what it takes to build like V4, V5, whatever it may be, so be it.
Yeah, and I wouldn't be surprised if in the near future people are using AI in these bot races as well.
In the early days, we had a lot of GPT-based
bot races,
but then they got outcompeted pretty much. But
yeah, I mean, that's just using ChatGPT. I think if you really want to capture market, you've got to build your own models. And that goes with anything.
Oh, yeah.
Custom stuff is always best.
I completely agree because if you're just building on somebody else's stuff, your competition can do the exact same thing really easily. There's nothing special about what you're providing. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I built iChaser from scratch was because I kind of wanted something that I could... I believe I mentioned this earlier on in the podcast. I pretty much made a self-imposed rule of not looking on any analyze tools that were currently available because I kind of wanted to go down my own quote-unquote skill tree. But yeah, I totally agree that building your own stuff, if you actually want to get to the absolute limits of what is possible, you have to build your own stuff. There's no way around it. Because you can't be number one if you just build on somebody else's thing, because technically they are number one, indirectly.
Well, you can modify it. You can modify it and learn from it. But yeah, it depends how you define number one, though.
Like,
look at Steve Jobs. He was copying all these other designs and putting his own twist on it.
A, and there you go, evaluation, and B, training
MDOS,
of their self-driving car model in the simulation. And the
But man, I really hope you get into very the AI world piece of engineering
model
and join the revolution
using a combination of Unreal Engine, which is a game engine,
all the best with the bot races, and hopefully the synthetic
data generation, both by generative AI, but also just other AI methods.
We should definitely arrange something, maybe 6-7 months from now.
The reason why the other reason why simulation is really important
definitely.
And helpful
until then
is because
take care.